The politics of naming an out-of-state resident certainly played into this.
One of the governor's nominees for a state board position withdraws. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, harsh public criticism for rewritten legislation on the permitting process.
I think it's perfectly ludicrous that we're not even getting enough time to comment on a bill that removes our ability to comment.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
A Californian who had been tapped by Governor Sean Parnell to serve on a high-profile state board withdrew his name from consideration on Wednesday evening. Dennis Mandel of Salinas sent a brief email to the governor's office to say he no longer wanted to be part of the State Assessment Review Board because of the appointment's, quote, political nature. Legislators from both parties have made public statements this week that appointing someone who resides in another state to an Alaska board could be a violation of the law. At a press availability today, Governor Sean Parnell said he did not ask Mandel to pull his name, but that confirmation would have been difficult.
You know, he's an incredibly professional and qualified individual. Everybody who met with him thought that. But the politics of naming an out-of-state resident certainly played into this.
Parnell stood by his decision to appoint a non-resident. Democrats in the legislature have been especially opposed to Mandel's nomination. On top of the residency issue, they've raised concerns about Mandel's career in the oil industry and about his tax records. On Thursday morning, Representative Andy Josephson, an Anchorage Democrat, released information that the state of California suspended Mandel's business license in 2009 for failure to pay corporate income taxes. Josephson says his office learned about the tax violations through a simple Google search and that he feels the Parnell administration did not fully vet Mandel.
Someone at boards and commissions could have done a Google search and looked into this and said, boy, Mr. Mandel, we love you, but we are a little concerned we're going to have some pushback on the California factor. And now we see that you haven't paid your corporate income tax when this very job is about imposing actually a property and equipment tax. And that should have been a red flag.
The State Assessment Review Board is in charge of resolving disputes over the value of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and the number they decide on can result in tax bills in the hundreds of millions of dollars for oil companies. Parnell's other appointee to the State Assessment Review Board is an Alaska resident and is still going through the confirmation process. Bernie Washington of Anchorage answered questions at the first of two confirmation hearings today. Washington has served as the chief financial officer of Alaska Public Media, the parent company of KSKA, KAKM, and the Alaska Public Radio Network since 2010. The legislature will vote on Parnell's nominees in April. After nearly a year of waiting for a rewrite of HB 77, members of the public had plenty to say about the changes. They got their first chance to speak to them at a Senate Resources Committee hearing yesterday. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that most of the testimony on the Parnell administration's permitting bill was as negative as it was brief.
The tone of the hearing was set with the first person to testify. Bobby Andrew had flown in from Dillingham to speak on behalf of Nunamta Alukestai, an association of tribes and village corporations in the Bristol Bay region. Last year, the group had taken the stance that the bill had gone too far in overhauling land management policy. And Andrew said the release of a new version on Monday had not changed their position. He testified that even though some of the more controversial parts of the bill had been rewritten, his association thought the legislation still gave too much authority to the Natural Resources Commissioner and that it did not give the public enough opportunity to weigh in on certain permitting decisions. That was as far as Andrew got before a timer went off and committee chair Kathy Giesel told him to close his testimony.
Bobby, your 2 minutes is up. Why don't you summarize?
That was quick.
The committee ran through testimony at a screaming pace, not even stopping to let legislators ask questions. About 50 individuals got to speak, and 100 more were told to submit their testimony in writing instead. Just two people came out in favor of the bill: Mary Sattler, a manager with Donlin Gold, and Mike Satry, who was speaking on behalf of the Council of Alaska Producers, a mining association. Most of the people who spoke against the bill suggested it would limit public involvement. They focused on language setting a higher bar for legal standing to appeal a decision. They found problems with the section allowing the Department of Natural Resources to issue general permits for a broad range of activities that multiple users can operate under. And they said a single 30-day comment period was not adequate time to address those kinds of permitting decisions. But as the hearing wore on, testimony began to focus on the public process being used to move a bill dealing with public process. Rosemary McGuire, a fisherman from Cordova, described the situation as ironic.
I think it's perfectly ludicrous that we're not even getting enough time to comment on a bill that removes our ability to comment.
Giesel, an Anchorage Republican, defended the way the testimony was handled immediately after the hearing adjourned. At that point, she had decided there would be no more oral testimony because of time constraints.
We're not hearing anything new. Did you hear anything new and unique in any of the testimony? I did not. And therefore, there's really no productivity to hearing the same thing over and over again, especially when it can be submitted in writing.
But Giesel softened shortly after the meeting, and she decided to schedule another hearing for public testimony on Friday afternoon because of the large response to the bill. While testimony will still be limited to 2 minutes, Giesel has indicated that this time she will hear every person who signs up. Senator Click Bishop, a Fairbanks Republican who serves on the Resources Committee, thinks giving people more time to review the bill could affect public sentiment on it. The legislation is long and complex, and a number of sections have been substantially reworked.
They've only had 48 hours to look at the bill, and I think it's just hypothetical on my part. I believe if some of those people had some more time to digest the language, that maybe they would be a little softer on their stance.
Bishop says that he, too, is still digesting the bill. His office is still reviewing it, and he needs more time to decide whether he will support it. Bishop is seen as a critical vote for the bill to pass, as is Soldotna Republican Peter Machicki, who worked with the Parnell administration on the rewrite. The Resources Committee plans to make further adjustments to the bill after testimony is complete. It is then expected to be sent to the Senate floor if it can secure the votes. The legislation already passed the House last year. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
The head of the Federal Drug Administration told a U.S. Senate committee today her agency is still working on its review of an application to produce a genetically modified salmon. Director Margaret Hamburg gave no indication when the FDA would issue a decision.
Actually, we got, I think, was it 33 or 35,000 comments? So this is a topic that people care a lot about. We're going through those comments, taking them very seriously. And, we will be moving forward in a deliberate, science-driven way.
Aqua Bounty Technologies says its fish would be farmed inland and would be incapable of breeding. Opponents, though, say the fish would threaten natural salmon runs and cause confusion in the marketplace. Ahead of the FDA decision, Friends of the Earth is pressing supermarket chains to agree not to carry the product. Last week, it added Safeway and Kroger to its yellow light list of retailers, those that say they have no plans to carry genetically modified salmon. Target and Trader Joe's made the environmental group's green light list with policy pledges not to carry the product. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a simple change nudges Petersburg kids toward healthier choices.
We had water. We had accessible water, but kids were not going to all the water fountains because they didn't like the way it tasted, what it looked like when they put in their water bottles.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Over 800 Alaskans are diagnosed with serious brain injuries each year. 150 will die from their injuries. A variety of activities such as snow machining, riding ATVs, and playing sports carry risks of brain injury or concussion. Prevention, diagnosis, and treatment are important. Safety is a way of life. Think ahead. Protect your brain. Learn more at alaskabraininjury.net. This message brought to you by the Alaska Brain Injury Network.
Members of the federal agency that oversees marine mammals held a teleconference in Nome yesterday to solicit region-specific advice on emergency response. It's part of a process to draft environmental protocols for the Arctic that incorporate local expertise. Sadie Wright is a biologist with the National Marine Fisheries Service. In the wake of the massive 2011 Deepwater Horizon oil spill, the agency is making a proactive attempt at developing protocols for emergency response in the Arctic. And Wright says they want them to be adapted to specific areas.
We want the plan to be regionally specific within the Arctic. So we're going to communities and to work with community members to make the plan regionally specific and really iron out the communication between our agency, National Marine Fisheries Service, and the local communities.
Yesterday's meeting was focused on how to respond to emergencies related to the marine mammals that NIMFS is responsible for, seals and whales. And residents from communities with robust seal harvests like Shishmaref, Teller, and Diomede called in to offer advice, problems, and what they're observing with seals in the region. Some of the feedback involved making the language in instructions for collecting samples from sick animals clearer. Instead of using technical scientific terms, one caller recommended finding language for seal parts that hunters are more familiar with. Wright says there was other advice she wasn't aware of before the teleconference.
Folks on the phone had some good advice. They said webinars might work well, and perhaps having village coordinators in the villages outside of Nome to help coordinate information.
At the national level, there are facilities and personnel spread across the country with expertise at emergency response. But Wright says NIMFS wants those capabilities to be complemented by how subsistence users in affected regions act as first responders and experts on many of the marine mammals the agency is interested in.
Right. Our agency, I mean, especially after Deepwater, has a lot of expertise in running samples for contaminants analysis. So we wanted a plan that incorporated all of those existing protocols where we have a lot of expertise, but incorporates all of the local contacts and information so that we can get the samples routed to those labs. So connect the expertise.
Yesterday was just the first exchange in what NIMFS is hoping will be an ongoing process. Their next step will involve soliciting more specific feedback on response procedures and potentially gathering contact info for local coordinators. The group of officials that came to Nome are slated to head to Kotzebue later this week and on to Barrow for more meetings next week. Governor Sean Parnell has released a report on last summer's law enforcement sweep of placer mines in the 40 Mile area. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, it finds mixed blame for the heavy-handed law enforcement that upset miners.
The Environmental Protection Agency led an armed team of federal agents and a representative from the State Department of Environmental Conservation into the 40 Mile Mining District August 19th through the 22nd last summer. The effort targeted water quality violations at small-scale placer mines and intimidated their operators, accustomed to a less intrusive regulatory approach. The contracted for state report on the raids finds no laws were broken by agents, but speaking at a press availability Thursday, Governor Parnell said it also finds the manner of the raids was an unnecessary deviation from past oversight.
This was such a departure from the norm. and it appears to be without foundation.
The report says no criminal charges have so far resulted from the raids. It also finds earlier claims of drug and human trafficking in the 40-mile area were discredited by Alaska State Troopers well prior to the August raids, but a lack of communication resulted in the information not getting back to federal authorities. Parnell acknowledged the state also bears some responsibility for what happened.
I'm also not satisfied with the failure of timely and complete communication between our own personnel in state government. In light of the report, I've issued directives to my commissioners and attorney general to ensure that state involvement in such activity, at least the way it occurred here, that it never happened again.
Parnell attributed some of the problem to federal-state staff interactions that left out higher-level oversight, emphasizing that the armed raids set up a situation that could have turned violent.
EPA's actions unnecessarily put Alaska mining families at risk, and something tragic could well have occurred, and thankfully it did not.
Governor Parnell said he's asking the chairman of the U.S. House Resources Subcommittee to request EPA documents and staff the agency refused to make available for the state report. He also anticipates a state legislative hearing on what happened. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Longtime Tanana Chiefs Conference President Jerry Isaacs stepped down today after 8 years at the helm of the consortium that represents 42 interior Alaska Native villages. Isaac gave a final report at TCC's annual convention in Fairbanks, crediting people of the region with helping him rise to the challenge.
I don't know why I was led to take up the responsibilities of leadership, but my elders in my village, the tribal leaders of the interior, and all of you lifted me up and gave me strength.
Isaac said he's come a long way from the racism he suffered and the anger it inspired in him as a young man.
Where I wanted to be very radical in my native views, over the years you notice that I've toned down. Now I think of education and intelligence as a better measuring tool by which to advance our people.
Isaac highlighted many things that TCC has been able to accomplish while he was at the helm, including a recent historic foster care agreement with the state,
in which the state will now recognize tribally licensed foster homes and reimburse the tribes 100% for children in tribal custody who are placed in foster homes by our tribal courts.
Isaac also pointed to TCC's financial recovery.
Together with your help, we were able to turn around a $3 million deficit and increase our annual revenue from $83 million to a year to more than $120 million this year.
Isaac listed numerous capital projects built with funding secured from the state and federal governments, including native healthcare facilities in Fairbanks and many rural villages. Isaac said he'll stand behind the new TCC president and plans to stay active and find a new job.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The 2014 U.S. Nordic Skiing National Championships and Super Tour Finals are set to start in just over a week in Anchorage. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Originally, the races were slated to take place on the trails in Kincaid Park. But since snow has been hard to come by in Anchorage this winter, race director James Southam says today officials decided to move the races to alternate locations.
All the distance races are going to be at the Hillside Ski Trail, racing around the Spencer Loop and the Besh Loop. And then the sprint race is going to be held at the APU ski trails over by the Alaska Pacific University campus.
Southam expects up to 150 skiers from around North America to participate. He says it's a unique opportunity for Alaskans to see some of the best skiers in the nation competing in person.
It's going to be the first time, and really the only time all season, that that our World Cup athletes like Keegan Randall and Holly Brooks, Sadie Bjornsson, will be competing in the U.S., much less Alaska.
Races start on Saturday, March 22nd, and run through Friday, March 28th. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
For more information on the races, go to alaskapublic.org. Students' physical well-being is paramount to how well they perform in school. The Petersburg School District is hoping to improve that through a four-year, $600,000 grant, which started this school year. An update on the grant was given to the district school board at their last meeting. KFSK's Angela Denning reports.
So far, the Healthy Living Grant has helped wellness projects in all of the schools. That includes 10 modern water fountains being installed that feature a place to fill water bottles. Ginger Evans is the Healthy Living Grant Coordinator.
And the kids are loving it. You can see them going and filling up their water bottles. The water is much colder, it's filtered.
Petersburg is one of 9 districts in the state to receive the grant through the Department of Health and Human Services under the Obesity Prevention and Control Program. Evans says drinking water was one of the main components of the grant.
We had water. We had accessible water, but kids were not going to all the water fountains because they didn't like the way it tasted, what it looked like when they put in their water bottles. So this is very exciting that this is happening.
The hope is that if students are drinking from their water bottles, they're not consuming other sugary drinks. The Healthy Living Grant is also helping to fund breakfast for high schoolers and fifth graders. For the older students, it's called the Second Chance Breakfast Program. Before this year, breakfasts were not available for the teenagers. Now, about 35 students a day eat at the school in the morning.
Kids who have free and reduced lunch can use that for the Second Chance Breakfast, or they can purchase it, and the kids really seem to be enjoying it.
It's amazing. It's 35 people that are eating something, and they're all, you know, complete meals, nutritious meals for the most part, and so that's awesome.
Carly Wells is the Food Service Program Director. She also gave an update to the school board on how the grant is helping. She says it's funding a new pilot program for the fifth graders through the Healthy, Hungry, Free Kids Act. She says before the program, they were feeding 80 meals per week. Now that's jumped to 150.
So we're looking at, you know, seeing if that increases our participation, feeds our kids, and how that impacts those students.
The middle school students have had a breakfast program in place that allows them to eat at school if they want. But school board member Sarah Holmgren says it's the high schoolers who might need that meal the most.
I'm willing to bet a lot of them go out the door, not even breakfast, whereas in middle school, parents still tend to make sure they get a breakfast or they're eating at school. So this is great. I'm really happy to hear that this has been done.
The Healthy Living Grant also supports the esteem-building Girls on the Run program in the grade school, as well as after-school snacks for all students. Another health-related program that the school district is implementing will allow parents to keep tabs on the finer details of the school's menu. It's a new computer software program. Again, Carly Wells.
What this is going to allow us to do is we're going to be able to have all of our calorie counts and all of our nutritional data for every parent who wants to know. So this is going to be amazing, super amazing.
She says part of the grant is proving to the state that the district is meeting their nutritional requirements, which she says Petersburg has no problem doing. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
A lot of elements go into a simple comic book. There's artwork, there's editing, and most importantly for the Filipino and Canadian comic writer Jay Torres, there's the script. The award-winning author visited Onalaska's schools and gave a presentation at the library last week as part of a statewide tour. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
Archie, Batman, Teen Titans, Jay Torres has worked on some of the most famous comic book series out there. But Torres told kids and parents in Onalaska that the big name books are no sweat compared to the challenge of dreaming up his own comics. That's because he needs artists to help bring his stories to life.
If I put panel one, Batman flies through a window, I'm done. Right? The artist doesn't have to get me to describe who Batman is, what he looks like, right? But if I say Rufus is standing on the doorstep of his grandmother's house, the artist is going to say, who the heck is Rufus? So I have to describe Rufus and what the grandmother's house looks like.
Rufus is the hero of Bigfoot Boy, a comic Torres wrote for younger readers. Rufus is an average kid who finds a magical amulet. When he puts it on, he can transform into a Sasquatch. Torres says Bigfoot Boy is his favorite comic he's worked on, and he wanted to share it in Onalaska. Torres was in town on the Alaska Spirit of Reading Tour, which brings authors to the state every year. After Onalaska, he'd be off to Sitka and Juneau to visit schools and hold public readings.
Usually when an author does a reading, he or she stands here and reads from the book.
But comic books are visual, and besides, Torres doesn't draw them, he writes them. The stories, the dialogue, everything down to the sound effects in each panel. So he decided to do things a little differently. He invited the children in the audience to read the words he wrote, which were projected on a screen.
Almost like doing a play. So, okay, who's going to play Rufus for me? You? Okay, come on up. What's your name?
Ethan. In the first chapter, Rufus, played by volunteer Ethan Eisler, gets sent to stay with his grandmother. His parents drop him off in the unfamiliar neighborhood as birds chirp in the background.
Tweet, 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 tweet. Northwood
is a cool place. You'll see, Rufus. Just listen to your grandmother, okay?
Yes, Mom.
The kids responsible for sound effects had their hands full. In one panel, Rufus sat in his grandmother's living room while she took a nap, and a string of Z's ran across the screen.
Snoring.
They got the hang of it as Rufus wandered through the woods. A Bigfoot approached in the shadows.
Okay, let's have a round of applause for our reader.
After the reading, Mary Hymas, a fourth grade teacher, wanted to know,
yes,
what advice do you have for some budding elementary school comic writers?
Write, draw all the time, as much as you can. You know, practice makes perfect. It's like anything else. You want to be a good ice skater? Go ice skate. You want to be a good piano player? Play the piano.
Even if you live on an island in the Bering Sea, anything's possible. Torres says that he works with artists and editors from all over the world, even though he's based in a comfy suburb of Toronto.
So that's the beauty of working in comics and also books and illustration in this day and age. You don't have to leave your house if you don't want to. You can do it from anywhere in the world. Right, guys?
Yeah.
Including Alaska.
The important thing is to immerse yourself in what you love, Torres says. That's why he read lots of comics as a kid and still does now. And that may be why there was a run on comic books at the end of Torres's talk. Library assistant Robbie Harris was mobbed by kids wanting to check out the latest installment of Bigfoot Boy. That included junior high student
Ethan Rising.
I know.
Okay. Am I here that often?
You're here enough.
I'm only here to get to...
There's nothing wrong with coming in the door. We'd like to see you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
There's a good reason why Ethan's there so often. He says he's writing his own comic book series. For now, it's just stick figures, but it's a start. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Angela Denning in Petersburg, and Lauren Rosenthal in Onalaska. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by Doy Unlimited, announcing the 2014 annual shareholder meeting on Friday, March 14th at the Westmark Hotel in Fairbanks. Information at doyon.com.
If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.